And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
I am Jeremy Heide.
And this week we have special, special, special guests, Laura and John, with us. You might know them as Naughty La from the
right.
League of Non-Aligned Knitters.
And, hi.
and John is, of course, Tijan from Voices of Babylon and the instigator of the Critical Myth podcast.
Hey, how you doing, everyone?
Thanks for joining us tonight, guys.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's awesome to be here.
and it's good to get familiar voices back on the show to talk about these books, because other people have read some books more than others, and people like me didn't do their homework this week.
Uh-oh.
Hey, I already tweeted that I didn't do my homework. I put it out there at the beginning. Hey, I didn't do it. Got caught up in other things, but hey, it's all good, because you guys are here to carry the wagon. I will just sit back and navigate.
All right. All right. Good work on that, John Candy.
Oh, hush. I have a couple of things. In the quest to find cover art for the novels so that we can throw them up on the video stream, I ran across something unexpected in terms of the trilogies. Didn't the out-of-print copy of, what was it? It was book two of the Technomage trilogy? Book two or book one?
I think it was book two. That was the expensive one for me.
Okay. I was looking around on Amazon, and none of the Technomage books seem to be outrageously priced anymore. Yeah. I see. All right. Here it is. Book two, Summoning Light. 17 copies new for $3.89.
Oh, my God.
52 used copies for 16 cents.
Are you...
Somebody must have found a box somewhere.
Somebody must have found a pallet. Okay.
And they don't know what they really have.
But that's this thing. The book one... it says 9 new copies from $34 and 22 used from $15. So I'm sitting here going, wait a minute.
It might be the first book.
But still, that's not the $90 people were asking for it a couple of years ago.
Right. I think I picked up the out of print one for off of eBay for around, I think it's like $48, and I was all stoked because I got it so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But yeah, that's still cheaper than what I got it for.
Yeah, $15 bucks is actually not bad.
No, not at all.
Well, did you happen to stumble across the third book in the Centauri Prime trilogy? Because I know that's the other one that's out of print. In fact, that's the only one I knew. They're all out of print, but that's the one that seems to be the hardest for me to find without mortgaging my future.
Yeah.
Which one was that? That was Out of the Darkness, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Out of the Darkness is still a little pricey. 5 new for $60, 25 used for $24. But still, that's not the 100 and some that I had seen them at.
Yeah. Wow. You know what? I mean, as much as I love B5, dropping 100 bones on a book just kind of, that's where I...
It depends on the book.
I don't care how much Kosh screams jump now in my ear, I think.
If you had the spare scratch, would you pay $100 just for volume 15 of the script book?
Depends
on the book. It really does.
Yeah, but that's a different animal though, because that one's got the original outline for the full on Babylon 5 / Babylon Prime. And that's like the ur text. that's a different thing because, you know, the Legions of Fire stuff just didn't impress. So that's why I'm not sure I'd drop that kind of money on it. But fifth, because the other part of it is the only way to get the 15th volume was to
buy all 14.
All 14, right, exactly. So that's a different animal altogether, too.
I've got that, by the way. not selling it, though.
No, I would be very surprised to see any of those get out of people's hands.
Exactly. So it was like the rarity of it combined with the squeaky cool factor of it, the chances of finding somebody selling one is rare. But if you saw them selling it and you had the extra money to buy it, yeah, I mean, I would. I mean, even though my copy is personalized to me from JMS himself, if I saw someone selling a copy of it and I could, like, you know, retrieve it from the wilds, I would. You know, there might be like two other books that I'd pay more than $50 for, but I'd have to be really, really a lot more financially secure than I am right now.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, and it occurs to me, I mean, if you're at that point, what book years and years ago when I was a teenager, I was a regular babysitter for a family, and the parents owned a gorgeous collection of Robert McCall. It was a Robert McCall painting book. I can't even think of the word, but a portfolio kind of thing. And ooh. McCall is one of the, I mean, he was a major space artist who did a lot of stuff for NASA, but also did some pre-production stuff for Buck Rogers, that series. His stuff was cool before it got silly. But anyways, the book was gorgeous. And man, I'd love to have that on my bookshelf. And that's one, if I had the scratch, yeah, I could see dropping 100 bones on that.
Yeah. There's a few things out there that when I did have the scratch, I tried to get it, but I couldn't. And then
right.
I don't have the scratch now, so I can only dream. The tops on my list is actually not sci-fi related. Well, it kind of is, but it's not. The original blaster from the original Battlestar Galactica is way up high on the list. But
oh, there you go.
Before I moved from New Jersey to Arizona, I happened to be wandering through an art store. And I was waiting for them to give me a quote on replacing a frame of mine that had broke. So I'm flipping through, you know how they have those floor stands of unframed prints?
Yep.
I'm flipping through one of those, and one catches my eye. It's like 4 feet tall, 3 feet wide, and it's a Leroy Neiman of Nolan Ryan on the pitching mound in the Astrodome in the old ice cream colors Astros uniform. He's right. Like in mid delivery. And I'm like, holy cow, my favorite pitcher of all time in a Leroy Neiman that I've never seen before. Holy, right, this is yeah. cool, right? And then I noticed that it was signed by Leroy Neiman. And then I noticed it was also signed by Nolan Ryan. And I just squeed right there in the store. I'm like, ah, my God. What? No. And it was $4,000.
Yeah.
and literally, if I wasn't a week away from moving to Arizona, I would have bought it right then.
Yeah, sure.
I don't care if I would have had to have eaten macaroni and cheese for a month. I had the money. I would have bought it.
Right.
And I called for like a year after I left. I'm like, because the guy had it on consignment. It had been in that store for like 2 years. And I'm like, I couldn't have seen this 2 years ago.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
So yeah, that was the tops of my list. $4,000 for a Leroy Neiman print that was signed by both of them. Like, oh my wow. God. That would have, you know, just hung up on my wall very nicely. But the other thing I wanted to mention that is sci-fi related, Bryan Singer is producing a web series, and I have had the privilege of seeing a preview of the first 12 episodes. They range in about 5 to 6 minutes each. And the best thing I can say about this series is I want to see the rest of it right now.
Wow.
Because of how addictive what I was watching was.
So what's the name of the series?
It's called H Plus.
H Plus.
H Plus, the digital series. It's about what happens when it's a dystopian series, but it's so freaking cool. It's people adapt an implant. It's basically what happens when transhumanism connects us all and what happens when that breaks. Or more to the point, is destroyed. And how do we pick up the pieces afterwards? And the storytelling is kind of broken. It sort of follows like two or three different storylines at the same time. But the way they're intermingled, like each episode, following each episode is very easy. Just knowing what happened previously in that one segment. But it looks like they're weaving together a larger story of what happened. Cause like there's one storyline that happened 7 years earlier in Finland. There's one that's happening right now. There's one that happened 5 months ago. There's one that happens 10 years from now. Or is it 10 years or 20 years? And I'm just sitting here going, I'm watching it, I'm going through the playlist, watching all the episodes that they've given me access to. And I get to the last one and I'm going, bastards, I want to watch all of it right now. So knowing how picky I am about my storytelling.
Yeah.
And knowing that I had not yet 100% forgiven Bryan Singer for what he did with X-Men 3 and Superman Returns. All right. That was two strikes. That was two strikes in one swing, man. That's hard to do. That's hard to do. Anyway, I did not think X-Men 3 lived up to what he had done, what he had started in 1 and built up in 2. Because 2 for me is pretty darn close to the perfect X-Men movie, the perfect Marvel movie. I have not seen Avengers yet. Hush.
Okay. All right.
But as a diehard Marvel girl, whose favorite title was X-Men. My favorite title was X-Men. Okay. Those characters were me, you know, Alienation Central. That was my life in high school and college. The X-Men 2, I openly cried in several places.
Yeah. Having, I have to say, up until the most recent Marvel cinematic adventures, I would agree that X-Men 2 was probably the best that they had put out.
Well, like I said, after watching X-Men 3 and then watching Superman Returns, I was angry with Bryan Singer. I wanted to find him, sit him down in a bar, and have a chat with him.
I didn't think Superman Returns was that awful. It wasn't great, but...
Really? Come on.
Well, anyway. I mean, we could have that conversation another time, but Superman, sure. I think, is a very difficult character to work, but anyways.
He's a very complex character, and major props for taking him on. Major props for getting Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. That was brilliant. But when I saw X-Men First Class, I forgave his transgressions for X-Men 3.
Mm-hmm.
X-Men First Class was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Seeing I don't know how much of his hand is in this new series, H+. But my God, the storytelling in it is just, like I said, it's addictive. There's 48 episodes, 12 of which I was able to watch that most other people won't be able to see for a few months. And I want to see it all right now. That doesn't happen a lot. So wherever you are, Brian, thank you for H+. You're 99% forgiven. What can I say? I'm a tough sell, you know.
That's all right. Well, you get that close, you're doing all right, I suppose.
Yep. So that's all I had to say. I have to promote this because it's just way cool. First episode should be up for everybody to see on August 8th, And I will post a link to it. People in the, you can see the trailers for it. If you go to YouTube and search for H Plus Digital Series, you'll see it. It's way cool. But anyway.
All right. But we digress. Well, yes. I think it's probably a good time to take a quick break. And then we will jump right back into the deep geeking. What do you say, guys?
Sounds good.
All right. Works for me.
Hey Kev, Dad's asleep. Let's do an experiment.
What experiment?
The one from Mythbusters, where they put the guy's hand in the water to see if he would pee on himself. Let's try it on Daddy.
Hey kids, what are y'all doing?
Nothing, Mom.
Do you have your own little geeks? Need some ideas to keep them out of trouble? Well, check out the How to Grow Your Geek podcast.
We have cool kids' books and movie reviews.
We have awesome game reviews.
And we have interviews, advice, and a whole lot of fun. Check us out at
HowToGrowYourGeek.net.
And we are back with our special guests, Laura and John, to talk about the seventh book in the original novel series, To Dream in the City of Sorrows. Now, that was one of the ones that was actually reprinted by Del Rey when they acquired the B5 titles from Del. I must say, like I said, if you look at the picture, I think Jeremy has the image. I sent it to him anyway. If you look, was this number 7 or number 9? Whatever.
Number 9.
It was number 9.
Number 9, yep.
Okay. It's number 9. If you look at the covers, it's very easy to see why someone like me who was in a hurry just saw the name Babylon 5 on the novel and bought it, because the new cover looks nothing like the old cover and there's no number on it. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the second cover, the Del Rey cover, it's kind of in line with what they ended up doing with the Technomage trilogy. It's more of like a photo montage as opposed to a painting. Although with the original Del edition, at least the painting for the cover of To Dream in the City of Sorrows actually pertains to the novel, because you've got not only the characters involved, but you've got a small image of the crystal buildings in Tuzanor, and you've got white stars flying overhead. And it's clear that in this case, somebody actually read the manuscript, as opposed to, okay, we got these three characters and paint the station. You know, which is, you know, pretty much what the other Del novels were. So this one was written by Catherine Drennan, who at the time was married to J. Michael Straczynski, doing some reading. This is the first one that's really acknowledged to be 100% canon. And just to get my own little pet peeve off my chest, people, it's C-A-N-O-N, not C-A-N-N-O-N. I will point a cannon at your cannon if you misspell canon.
Wait a minute. There are people getting that wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
constantly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that. Oh my goodness. I'm gonna have to bring out my grammar police.
Oh, it's horrible. But that's just me. All right, but I digress. According to the preface inside of the book that's written by JMS, he mentions that Brennan was constantly quizzing him about what happened to Sinclair after he left B5. In the interim between Chrysalis and Points of Departure. And so he finally kind of, well, let's figure it out, and why don't you write the book? And So she did. Now, he gave her, I think, if I recall correctly, because I don't have my novel in front of me, he gave her the salient points, but she pretty much wrote the story as it is. So there you are, the first of the 100% canon novels. And in fact, what did I see? I was looking through some stuff on Lurker's Guide, and JMS says that the other book that was written about this time is the Covellos book, The Shadow Within, which is the Anna Sheridan book. He says that's 90% canon, and To Dream is 100% canon. So that's interesting how you work out the percentages on that, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. Anyways, so that's kind of the long and the short of it. It's what happens to Jeffrey Sinclair once he's been reassigned to as ambassador to Minbar, to the point where he pilots Babylon 4 back in time to the First Great War 1,000 years ago. It's bookended by Marcus pondering all that he's seen in his time as a ranger and meeting Sinclair / Valen. And there we are, guys. So, John.
Yes.
Your overall impression of the book to start with, and then we'll start getting into the nitty gritty of it.
Okay. Well, I've read it a few times, including when it first came out, and my opinion has been different every time. The first time I read it, I devoured it in probably about 2 days, and I loved it. I revisited it, a few years later, and it wasn't quite as good as I remembered. And now this latest time preparing for this podcast, I think I found this nice middle ground between those. I'd say that my biggest regret for this novel is that it was made in the original novel run, because those novels were very tightly controlled in terms of length, and this book needed to be longer. I say that because the first 2/3 to 3/4 of the book are a nice, slow exploration of Sinclair's discovery of what his destiny is on Minbar, and he doesn't quite have all the pieces, but it really takes a while for everything to start coming together. It covers that period right there, covers maybe 2/3 of the second season.
Right.
And then you get to the final quarter, and everything just speeds up. And, you know, they're interspersed with Sinclair's story, which is, you know, something that I really appreciated as somebody who didn't even see the first season until after the entire series was over. Interspersed with his story was the story of Marcus and how he came to the Rangers.
Right.
And then also the story of what happened with Catherine Sakai from the time of roughly points of departure on to when, you know, she wound up with the Rangers and everything that happened in the book. So, yeah, they take a lot of time kind of moving the pieces around, getting Marcus to the point where he finally, you know, his story as described on the show comes to fruition in terms of how he came to the Rangers, and Catherine discovers what's really going on with Sinclair and kind of finally gets back to them being together. And then boom, there's a final thing that happens and that's it.
Yeah.
And to me, it was like, oh, wait, the pacing goes from this nice slow pace to just, oop, we're done. And then it's over. And you want there to be at least another 100 pages to match the depth of what had happened before. So overall impression, I still really enjoy it, mm-hmm. but it feels to me like it's just a little incomplete.
Gotcha. Laura, how about you? What did you take away from it this time around?
I have to agree a lot with John. I didn't even know that there were books in the universe until I started listening to the podcast, probably after the first year I started listening, and I immediately went and got my hands on as much of the canonical books as I could, and this being one of them. Now, the first time I read it, it was just amazing. I couldn't put it down, and I liked the slow build-up. with Sinclair having to assimilate himself into Mimbari society and failing somewhat, especially with the warrior class, just because they were so resentful of his presence. And then, yeah, all of a sudden, whoosh, light speed, and you're at the end of the book. And I was like, what? Well, what happened, you know? And there was so much more enrichment that could have happened in that last quarter of the book if it had been allowed to have been longer. You know, at the very end, I'm still wondering what happened to Catherine. And we kind of know what happens to Catherine, but you don't know exactly what happens to her unless you read the comic books, which I didn't do, and didn't find out what happened to Catherine until I listened to the podcast that covered the comic books.
Right.
Now, the second time I read it, I went in a little bit deeper. It, you know, I put it down and I pondered and I thought about some things. And I found things that I hadn't noticed before. Like, I didn't even realize until I read it the second time that Marcus had set foot on Babylon 5 before he even became a ranger. And yep. it was Babylon 5's sick bay that he recovered in. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't even notice that before. Yeah, you know, I was just so caught up in the action that I just, maybe I caught it and didn't sink in and I forgot. But I've only read it twice. And the second time, I would say I enjoyed it as much, but for different reasons. And yes, I totally agree with John. It could have been 100 pages longer, and I would have been happy.
And I think I agree with you. I think that this is one of the things that, I don't know, maybe I have no sense of time. I really felt like I felt in some ways a little bit opposite than you guys. When Sinclair gets in to Minbar, and I like how he's trying to integrate himself as an ambassador, and you get the sense that as ambassador from Earth, he's sort of being trivialized and marginalized. And
neglected,
and
too, yeah.
Yeah, right, neglected, right. That's a good word, too. Once he gets involved with the Rangers, it really feels... I'm not a military guy. I've never served. So any military folk out there, please set me straight. I know the Rangers have been around for 1,000 years and they've been training. I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, it, from the Ranger end of it, there's an elite fighting force. But it just seemed like Sinclair becoming, you know, as good as he was, seemed really rushed. And bringing the recruits in and making them into Rangers at the level they were, that seemed really I felt like it should have taken longer. So I don't know. Right. Somebody tell me whether or not the time frame, and maybe I missed what the time frame is. Maybe it's supposed to take longer, but I don't think so. You know, that's the thing. It's also correlated in with the events of what's happening on the station, you know, during the actual television series. And given the time frame correlating between when things are hitting with episodes, it's a fairly fast pace. And I guess I didn't quite buy that you could turn raw recruits into elite fighters in such a compressed time span.
I agree.
I'm former military, and I sort of was like, they throw him into the deep end as the leadership of this elite force without giving him hardly any training. Now he did get training from, God, what was the guy's name?
Durhan.
Sorry?
Durhan?
Yeah, he got, but as far as the philosophy and everything, and then I kind of pushed aside and said, well, he is Valen. Maybe he already kind of knew how he wanted to do it. You know, I had to rationalize it for myself, for me to not find that as a sticking point. But, and I think what they ended up happening as far as with the training of the recruits is they ended up not really going too in depth into the length of time that it would take to, you know, they were kind of fudgy on the time frame. You didn't know if Marcus's brother had been there a year or a month. You just kind of had to accept, okay, he's trained. He was there for some time.
Well, right. you can work it out, because we know that shortly after the events with Catherine at the end, that it's more or less just before Marcus is sent to Drazi, to the Drazi colony.
To Zagros, right? Dragra 7. Yes.
Okay. Exactly. Yes, thank you. So we know that that's the beginning of season 3. We know that Sinclair wasn't really training as a ranger until well into the beginning of season 2. So let's just guess, based on the Coming of Shadows, that it would have been maybe February, March. So we're talking about 10 months that he would have gone from being just finding out about the Rangers to being Entilzah for quite some time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that is pretty quick. My rationalization was that having been in the military for so long and having been in the Earth-Mimbari War, he was probably taught hand-to-hand tactics against the Mimbari at some point that might have given him an edge. My bigger problem was Marcus. Yes, he was said in the book in passing that he had been involved with the war, that he had some military training and so forth, because otherwise how would he have been such a good pilot and all that kind of stuff. But it still felt to me like he maybe would have been with the Rangers at the most 6 months before we saw him at Zagros 7.
Right.
That's right. For the depth that they talk about the Rangers and their training, and just how, not just military training, but the spiritual training, all of that, it seems ridiculously short, for especially considering that humans are supposed to be struggling to keep up with the Mimbari training regimen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was my biggest barrier to, but I think that was built into the timeline, and there wasn't a whole lot that the author could do about that.
Right. Well, I mean, learning a completely foreign philosophy system, too, for Marcus, you know, and he was already kind of brooding and had a bad attitude when he was on the mining colony. At least that's the feeling I got. Perhaps he was so focused on administrating that he couldn't open himself up to a bigger picture. So, yes, 6 months is a short amount of time to retrain your belief system, your philosophy, and break yourself out of that mold. So, yeah, I thought it was kind of fast, but she probably had certain constraints in which she had to work, and
oh well, there's no doubt of that.
I was so excited that the story was actually finally told to me. You know, I discovered it 10-20 years after it was actually told, but
right.
You know, I could dismiss all that.
Okay,
the first time.
You know, my feeling is, overall, I've never been that big a fan of the Sinclair character as a main character. In the first season, while there's some episodes where I think the character comes into focus, for the most part, for me, the show is carried by Londo Jacquard and the mystery that is Kosh. And I like Sinclair much more in the show when he is, for lack of a better term, the supporting character, where he shows up, you know, when Garibaldi gets the message, stay close to the Vorlon and watch out for the shadows. And then, of course, wrapping it all up with War Without End. So I don't know that maybe I wasn't invested enough in the mystery of what happened to him to be particularly compelled by the book, so I didn't find it as engaging. I also thought there were some things like that message to Garibaldi that were overly explained. You know, she spends pages with Sinclair going, how can I get this message to Garibaldi? Oh, I remember his favorite phrase is, keep your enemies close, your friends close and enemies closer. So I'll say, keep the Vorlon close. And it's just like, it's
really?
Like, it just kind of, it's like, oh, you know what? I got the whole subtext watching it in the show. I don't need you to spend paragraphs explaining it to me.
Leading I'm not.
You see, I actually liked that part.
Did you? Really? Okay.
I did, well, only because it gave more insight into his thought process. Because, you know, remember, I saw the end of his journey before I saw any of the beginning of it.
Okay.
So I, you know, when I went back and saw the first season, it was more filling in the pieces that I had really not experienced.
Yeah. Okay.
So for me, I was looking and going, okay, I'm looking at this book in terms of taking the Sinclair that was at the end of this first season, and how is he integrating the three sides of his nature to become Valen? And so part of that was seeing why did he say what he said? Why did he term it the way that he did? And I liked the fact that, you know, he was in the dark himself to a certain extent, and he was – that's one of those examples of, yes, it is a bit of, you know, continuity wank, as they say, but at the same time, there are certain pieces of that that were contextually a little different from how you might have taken it the first time when you watched the episode. There was more behind it, and that's what I liked about it, just that it filled in some of those gaps. And it's actually the fact that the end of the book just abruptly doesn't fill in some of the gaps.
Right. It leaves you with a few more questions. As far as that the part you're talking about, Tim, I'm kind of in between the two of you. In one episode, and I think in the book too, Sinclair is told you talk like a Minbari. Well, this kind of, because he had to be so cryptic in the message, it's all okay. Maybe he's, you know, it's. Out of necessity that he talks like a Minbari. I don't know. So it kind of answered that question. It's all, okay, he's not this super, you know, words are failing. intuitive person. He has to be cryptic because he can't say it straight out. So, you know, it kind of, answered the, well, why is he so cryptic in his speaking? Well, because a lot of it's code now. Now we know part of it is code.
Right. He got to the point on Minbar because of his isolation and what the Vorlons were doing in terms of interfering with those that were instructing him, that he had to speak cryptically just to get around that.
Sure.
And yet still get his message to you know, the recruits and to the Rangers, because whether or not he eventually found out what was going to happen, he needed to have control of them in the future. That was, you know, his goal. He didn't realize that he was going to be passing the Rangers on to Delenn and Sheridan, but, you know, he still knew that at some point the Vorlons are going to be a problem, and he's going to have the Rangers behind him, not behind them in some super reverent, way of that the Minbari were trying to set up at the beginning.
Right. He needs a support system in place.
Mm-hmm.
His infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I understand what you're saying. And from that point of view, I appreciate what you're saying. I just, again, yeah. Okay. I said my piece about that. The part of it is we see more of Narune involved in Sinclair's story, specifically when Sinclair is made Ranger One, but not necessarily given the title of Entil Zah. What do you guys think about the ceremony in which Sinclair was installed?
Well, it's clearly based on what happened in Gray 17 is Missing to some extent, but my problem with the whole Narune thing is that I didn't feel like it quite tracked.
Right.
I can see where the seams were in terms of trying to put the pieces together, but definitely the big sticking point was, while it works on the show for Narune to, in the military cast to kind of change the Grey Council. Because it's just off screen. It just kind of happens.
Right.
In the book, they have to try to explain it. And it doesn't quite work. It's like, okay, well, this happened. We have to make it happen somehow. So here you go.
It seemed too convenient the way in which they did it in the book. And I kind of felt that the Narune in the book was not quite as organic as he was in the show. He felt a little forced.
I still heard his voice in my head, but
yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. I think
that's hard not to have happen.
Right.
Right. But and I think overall, that's one of the problems I generally have is with this novel and some of the other ones is you really need to hear the character, you know, because that's the handicap here. We've got the television show, which is the touchstone. So you know how. In my mind, how successful the book is how, you know, can you hear that character, that actor speaking those lines of dialogue? And I think overall, I didn't get that sense of it.
Mm.
I did with Marcus and with Sinclair. Catherine, too. Not quite as much with Narun, because it just seemed like he was always defiant and angry. There was no subtext to him. There was no contrast.
Right.
But at that point in his arc, that's where he was. Because when we do see him in season two, when he talks to the Len, he says straight out, he's still angry. You know, and all alone in the night, he's still, like, when they told me what the truth was, I think the problem is again, that's what was there. And so she kind of had to work with that.
No, but I'll back up with Laura's saying, because, you know, you think about in Legacies, when Narun says to Sinclair, you talk like a Minbari, that is at least somebody who has a sense of has a better awareness of the subtleties around him. And yes, even while he was angry, you know, he tells Delenn, I'm angry about what happened. I didn't get the sense that it was a flat thing. There always seemed to be more substance to that character.
Right.
You
and
know,
I mean,
just,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and just the way, whether it's the way John Vickery was able to bring him to life
or,
yeah, right, exactly. And that's my point. It's like,
amazing.
He could be angry, but you knew that there was, you know, there was more than just the guy
deeper.
Saying, I'm angry and mad. Right. There was something very, very deeper. And in the book, he's just a hurdle that Sinclair has to overcome.
Right.
And he's not a living character.
And I see part of the problem of that coming out of, no offense to JMS on this one, but the first four issues of the comic. The things that were introduced in that actually caused probably more complications for this book than anything that was in the show, because I never bought the idea of Jennimer and Ducat's replacement and all of that, because it was never in the series proper. And it always felt like an intrusion on the concepts that were in the second season for the Grey Council. It just was, why does that need to be there? It actually doesn't really work.
Yeah.
And
in fact,
that's where I benefit from.
The old leader who's dying is kind of a cliche, and that was...
Right.
And a show that tended to avoid cliches or invert cliches... And I guess that's the thing, that's a cliche. I felt like the ceremonial drinking of the Minbari bourbon and coke or whatever it was. Oh, but it also happens to be poison to humans. And yes, you know, I know alcohol is poisonous to Minbari, so it's sort of an analog there. But it was just kind of like that. You know, it gets back to the Narun. That's just an obstacle as opposed to a character. You know, here's a trial for Sinclair to overcome. Yeah.
Like
he won't
prop.
Be able to drink this. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and
it was so fast and quick, and it just kind of happened, and then it was done. And did you also like the intentional reference to him being in a coma for 3 days?
Yes.
Yeah. To drive home the fact that, he's the Minbari Jesus, but anyway.
I thought just everything happens in threes.
Well, there's a reason for that, I guess.
But no, Marcus is Jesus.
He's Space Jesus.
That's a different one. Okay.
Yes.
Just like Swedish meatballs, each planet has their own.
Right.
Precisely.
Right. Okay. Yes. Yes. It's actually a franchise. It's the, you know, they're Jesus everywhere. It's more like Elvis, I think, at that point.
Oh.
With nicer robes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly. One thing with me not reading the comics. I didn't have a preconception on the whole Jennifer, and you know, I was just I took it at face value because I didn't have that other background. Now I guess I better get my hands on the comics.
Well, the gist of it is in the book. You don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the comic is really. Yeah.
Dodgy. It's dodgy.
okay.
Well, that one is the one that I don't know if you listened to the previous episode of the podcast where they talked about it, but the first issue was written by JMS, at least in part or, and then the other three were not and were editorially, manipulated, shall we say. So the consistency of that arc is abysmal.
But, Did I understand correctly that In Balin's Name would not be a waste of my time?
No, that's very good. I would. There's one extremely blatant editorial mistake in there, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
That actually kind of ruins the fact that that's supposed to be a little bit of an epilogue to this particular book. But at any rate,
the Catherine reference.
Yes. Exactly.
Although, you know, I read this before I read the comic. I thought it was pretty obvious what that was. And I guess that was, you know, in the end, that was it's like, okay, I guess I can. I liked the Catherine Sakai character in the show, and I liked that she just disappeared because to me, it's. I guess maybe. Having her come back, making her a more central character, and I know there's the relationship between her and Sinclair, but it also gets to the point now. It's like, well, every character is an important character, and I like in any given story in history, you know, the stories get woven together, and while one figure might be important in one particular historical account, they might just simply be footnote in another, and I embrace the fact that Catherine might have just been a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
What I liked about the handling of Catherine in the series is it lent some mystery to her, to where when I picked up the book to Dream in the City of Sorrows, I was all like, oh, I hope they have stuff about Catherine in here. So, you know, it made me anticipate learning more about her. And there was a mystery around her that really intrigued me.
And for all that there is that little mistake in the In Balin's Name comic, the end of this book makes it fairly clear what happened.
What was intended, yeah.
Yes, right. Exactly. So there, you kind of know. You don't really need to read that. It just kind of is a nice little send off to the whole Balin thing, a little extra. But yeah, this book left me with was this feeling like, okay, we just covered Sinclair's story in season two, but what happened between that and War Without End? Because actually I wanted to see what happened after the incident with Catherine.
Right. Right.
You know,
right.
Because we see him as we see him in War Without End and he's so different. And you can kind of get the context that this moment changed him and he was haunted by it.
Yeah, but he's very world weary.
Yes.
By that time.
How much do you think the problem may also lie in the constraint that we know what happens to Sinclair, and so that anything that happens in the book, unless you're a very deft writer, you can't really change anything. You know, in other words, like, for example, here's the thing, the deal with the fire water test that Sinclair has to take. I know he's not really in danger. There's going to be no harm there.
Right.
Because he's got to survive to pilot B4 back through the time rift.
To become Balin, right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
The sense of peril is lost. Yeah.
Right, right. So how much of that, you know, again, I don't know. That's that I think ultimately is my takeaway. It's okay. It has its moments, but ultimately I don't see where it gives me any greater insight to the universe or to the characters.
See, where I felt like, and maybe again it was from the perspective of having not seen his entire story beforehand.
Sure.
But I felt like, at least in part, I almost wish that some of this content had been on the show. it would have been interesting to, and I know that it really wasn't practical to do that, but I think that the Rangers as a concept didn't really gel until the third season with Marcus as kind of the stand-in for the Rangers in total. Yep. But this was a nice build towards that. And for that matter, it would have been interesting, again, to see Sinclair after this. You know, JMS in Babylon 5 in several different places had that trope of showing us that in the future, characters were going to survive at least that long. I mean, Londo and Jakar, very first episode. 20 years from now, we're going to kill each other. Okay, well, there you go. But in this case, yes, we know that he's going to survive that long, but it's the struggle to build up the Rangers that I thought would have been a very interesting story to tell. We got to see him built up as the leader to some extent, but we didn't really get him. You see, you know, because he's going to become Valen, we know what Valen represents, but for him to have actually been that individual in the past, there is a there is a gap between where he is at the end of this book and where he and who he's going to become.
And that might have been an interesting juxtaposition of storytelling. You know, would have been Valen 1,000 years in the past, crossing, you know, with the cutting between contemporary Sinclair, you know, and that's not to say that it can't be done. I think one of the things, not to derail the conversation, one of the things I was impressed with Covello's Technomage trilogy is that she did a good job of taking some events and particular very specific episodes and recasting those with some with the story she was telling behind the scenes, so that similar to the Londo Jakar arc, you saw the end, but the events to get you there are completely different than what you expect.
Right.
And it never feels like it's been cheated. The story works toward that end. And I think that's where ultimately I think City of Sorrows fails, is that it didn't give us that, hey, wait a minute, you know what happens to Sinclair, but you really don't know how he got there, and it's not what you think. You know, it pretty much kind of was what I thought. You know, not detail for detail, but you know, yeah, he's going to come in. The warrior cast was not going to be pleased about it. The religious cast would be all over him for whatever reason, and the Vorlons would be mysterious.
Which is, again, a reason why it would have been great if it could have happened around the same. It would have been great if it had been the trilogy, actually. Just to deepen some of these story points, because you can imagine that the struggle with the warrior cast could have been a lot deeper. It was fine as it was, but it could have been deeper. And then again, you know, all this stuff with the training of the Rangers.
Yeah, that would have been nice to have been able to get more depth on is the training, the what they had to go through, the philosophy, you know, just that's what intrigues me about the Rangers is because they're just so, again, words are failing me. they're just so multidimensional.
Excuse me. Yeah, they are apparently, in the series, they're painted very much as sort of the warrior philosophers.
Right.
And now the episode title eludes me, but it's the episode that in the fifth season that focuses very much on the training with Lanier and the other
learning curve.
Right. Thank you.
And we just got teased with that. I wanted more.
And actually, I mean, if to kind of circle back, if you think about it, Lanier's whole training thing actually kind of makes Marcus's training seem even more ludicrous. Because how long did Lanier, a Mimbari, take to really start to get even the basics down?
It was at least
far
6 months,
longer
I think.
Than, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Marcus must have been an incredibly good student.
Well, you know, the argument would be that Marcus was driven because of the death of his brother. But even with all that, it's still a ludicrous amount of time that he gets packed in so tight to become arguably one of the greatest Rangers.
But wasn't it said that Marcus joined the Rangers for the wrong reasons?
Yeah, it's almost a counter argument, because his whole psychological state would have actually been more of a detriment to his training.
Right, I thought that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, because where he was in his life was definitely not Ranger-like. So he wouldn't have had a leg up to begin with. In fact, he would probably have been, in real life, like the problem child, like the troubled troop.
Right, and it's shape up or ship out.
Right, or have to have the same lesson over and over and over again until it finally clicks. So basically he'd get washed back all the time until he finally figured out, well, okay, I have to release this to become that.
Yeah.
And what little we saw in the book was just glossing over all of that.
Right. He was having troubles in meditation.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, me too, but
yeah.
Well, I think it gets back to both of your points, Laura and John, that really the book, not maybe more than 100 pages, maybe, I don't know about a trilogy per se, but
well,
definitely
would have made four. You can't have four trilogies in the Babylon universe. That's be three. No,
that's right, exactly. Good point.
Fine. You could have made it the really long Babylon 5 hardcover.
Yeah. Right. I would have bought that.
Everybody would have. There's no doubt about
it. Right, but next that, to the one for the telepath war, since we're talking about an alternate universe, apparently.
That's the story I do. I want to see on film someday, but I digress.
I hear Edmund in the chat room screaming.
Yes.
Or is it in my mind? I'm not sure. Anyway,
that's scary.
All right. Any final thoughts on that before we take a break?
Nope. I think we've got it pretty well covered.
Yeah, I'm good.
Let me one last question for you before we go. And this is sort of the tail of the tape. Would you recommend it to a fan to read if somebody had never read it before? And I won't say whether they're a rabid B5 fan, casual fan. If somebody's never read it before, would you say pick up a copy?
Most definitely, yeah, I would. Because it just enriches the universe.
Okay. How about you, John? What's your...
I'll answer it this way. When I was proselytizing and sending out the videotapes of the show, I sent one book along with them. This was the book.
Gotcha. Yeah. Very good.
I have one question. Would you recommend people read this before or after In Valen's Name?
I would say before.
I can't answer that because I haven't read In Valen's Name.
I would say before only because it came out before In Valen's Name did. And so I think contextually it's meant to be in that order.
Okay.
All right, guys. Well, I think that was a rousing discussion. We're going to go ahead and take a break, and we'll come back. And so, yeah.
So, you're still hanging on to that tiny thread of denial. Trying to convince yourself that sci-fi has nothing whatsoever to do with your life. Well, you better think again, Sparky. That tiny cell phone has no basis in Starfleet communicators. Those hands-free earpieces now used by virtually everybody didn't come down from the ear of Lieutenant Uhura. And that cute little Rumba vacuum cleaner that you use far too infrequently wasn't hijacked off an Imperial Star Cruiser. Nah, not a chance. Because if it were true, then you would be forced to turn on that Flash Gordon-inspired box on your desk called a computer and listen to sliceofsci-fi.com. the Pexim Satellite Radio Show that will turn your sci-fi into reality.
And we're back with more Babylon Podcast. I am really glad you guys did your homework. Really, I am.
Got you off the hook.
You have no idea.
I noticed you didn't raise your hand at all at the back of the classroom there, so.
I was just wondering how long could I duck, you know, make the teacher not call on me.
Hey, I have a question for Laura, and this is just a general question, but I'm very curious about something. You mentioned that you are former military.
Uh-huh.
And from a general standpoint, how do you feel Babylon 5 did in its portrayal of military matters? And I know that's a big, huge question, so feel free to narrow it down as you like. But that's the thing. There's one of the things – let me preface it by saying this. One of the things that I've learned from doing the podcast early on is when I would make some proclamation about how, this doesn't – whatever, and then somebody would inevitably send in the voicemail going, well, Tim, guess what? So I'm stopping with the proclamations, but I am curious to know. So tell us what your experience is and what your perception is.
Well, I'll try to make this brief. Babylon 5 came out about 10 years after I got out of the military, so I wasn't, you know, hardcore, oh, that's wrong, oh, that's not right. But their ranking system confused me to begin with. They mixed both naval and army ranks within the military ranks, and I was able to kind of push that aside and saying, well, you know, maybe in the future they just do that. And the one thing, though, that I really had to come to terms with was how Garibaldi ran the security on the station. And the only way I could justify how laxed it was that he was private security. Military security would be a little bit more by the book. As far as their rank structure on the station, it was very clearly defined that you had a chain of command until Ivanova left, and then you didn't have really a second in command anymore, and that was a little odd too. But I hearing in retrospect what happened and why that happened, now I kind of understand why that gap wasn't filled. I don't think that if what Sheridan did in the Civil War were to happen nowadays, or even when I was in as just a commander of a far off station, that again was kind of hard to buy, but you know, it's science fiction, so you just go with it, right? Mm-hmm. There were some liberties taken, as Hollywood is wont to do, but they tried to stay within some stricture that the military would be understandable to both, you know, people who are in the military and people who have never been in the military. So I wasn't unhappy with it, I guess, is the way to sum that up.
Okay, sure.
And because it's science fiction, you can, you know, allow for some wiggle room.
All right. What service, which branch of the service did you serve in, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, I was in the Air Force.
Okay.
Yeah. Back in the 19...
That was a whole century ago, Laura.
did they have planes back then? Oh, wait. Yeah, the Wright brothers had flown by that time, yeah.
You were in the airship corps. Yes.
The dream of being a fighter pilot.
I was munitions and there were some problems I had with the science and the weaponry on Babylon 5, but again, I gave it a wink and a nod and just ignored it. The story itself was so rich that it didn't matter to me.
Okay. So there wasn't necessarily like some egregious thing that you were just going, oh my God, they got it. Oh, I can't believe
it. Yeah, I can't believe they did that, but oh well. Maybe physics changed by that time. I don't know.
Well, wait a minute. We had NASA people helping out with that Star Fury behavior.
Well, I'm not an expert on flying. It's munitions and not pulse particle cannons, but
okay,
ballistic munitions.
Gotcha. All right, we can argue about that.
I'm with you. I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
So what you're saying is a future episode of the podcast is going to be all about the ballistics on Babylon 5. That's a target audience.
that's what podcasting is all about.
That's about what 10 minutes worth of content. That'd be a short show.
we can argue about the advantages, the reasoning of how actually was it PPGs work versus slug throwers, and whether or not a slug thrower really could pierce the hull. Because let me tell you, if a slug from a 38 could go through the hull and decompress a 2.5 million ton station, I'm talking to somebody about who got awarded those contracts.
I was going to say,
exactly,
it's government contractors.
That's some crappy metal.
Yeah, right.
That's some really crappy metal alloy. Yeah.
I think one of the strengths of B5 as a whole is that, in terms of its storytelling, it was remarkably low on technobabble. Or, you know, making the resolution incumbent upon liberal definition of the laws of physics. You know, it really was more about the characters and the situations, and that's where its strength lies. Okay,
I like. No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, you know, as far as the choice of doing PPGs instead of, you know, slug thrower could be economical too. It's a lot more economical to arm and fire PPGs than it is to replenish your stock of bullets.
Not if you have God mode going, then you've got unlimited ammunition. Just saying.
Bringing it back to Sinclair, aren't you?
Right. Yeah. You're the one who was. You're the one who will never run out of bullets.
That's how we won the Shadow War back 1,000 years ago. Come on.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. All right, guys. Do you have anything else to add to this as we close out?
And now I can't get the image out of my head that you have to plug your PPG caps into a charger overnight. Oh my goodness, I can't
believe
it.
Right next to the cell phone, right next to your link.
Right.
That's right, like, yeah.
Plug the link in, plug the PPG caps in. Okay, you forever broken that for me. Damn it.
And don't forget to watch your socks.
Garibaldi would have been in an episode. He goes to shoot. It doesn't work. Oh, nuts. Yeah. Right.
I knew I forgot something.
And as turns a corner, he hears a ripping sound and goes, damn it, I should have zip fastened instead of fastened zip. Alrighty,
actually,
then.
It's a buck and a quarter theft, but I'm not telling him that.
Nice.
All right, Summer.
Arkel's breaking my brain here. He's like, I wonder if anybody wrote a B5 fanfic transplanting the Phantom of the Opera to the station.
You know, he could do that. Arkel could.
Arkel,
that sounds like a challenge.
Wait, Arkel, what's that rule about if you've brought it up, it's already happened on the internet?
Yep. Yeah. You either need to find that or write it yourself. That's your assignment, dear. Yeah. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. As always, the website is what?
What? Yay, what? Yay, we had Lauren and John join us. That was wonderful, that kind of yay. Not yay that it's over with.
I thought you had to wait.
I swear.
Okay. Okay, rails, we're back off there, exit 2. where are we? We're going to the website, BabylonPodcast.com. We have the schedule of the books and the rest of the collectibles that we're going to be talking about there. And if you want to help chime in, if you think your expertise on a particular niche of Babylon 5 memorabilia is greater than ours, come tell us, because we'd love to have you come on and educate us. Because literally, Tim and I can't know everything about Babylon 5. That would just make our lives sad.
And it's sad enough as it is.
That's true. If you want to email and Tim any suggestions, or both of us actually, any suggestions or any messages that you've recorded, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the voicemail number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year we all dreamt in cities of sorrow.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of Mimbar.